You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Matt's El Rancho, most impressive restaurant in all the world.
It's wonderful.
I can't believe my brother thought. What did he think? Were you part of this conversation?
Yeah, it was Matt.
He called you, didn't he? Or
he called me in, or he texted me in, my brother. I think he was asking about Matt's, Buford's.
And one other, I think it was Buford's.
There was another one. But then Matt's was second.
Yeah.
It rakes.
It rakes. Incredible service. You know exactly what you're going to get.
The place was a zoo. We got there at 4:30.
We had to swim out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Navigate.
That's why you go at 4:30, especially if you have kids. You bring them. My boys were running wild.
Yeah, it was Jack's first mats.
Yeah.
It's luckily, good. He slept most of the time.
He did. It was a great night. Great night. Stoked you being on the show today, but we're going to talk about something different. We're going to do a longer series at some point, so look out for that, freaks. But we're going to talk about the article that you just wrote. I think it's very prescient considering the narrative in the space right now, particularly around the reserve and all that. But first, we have to get a proper shill in for next week.
Yeah.
Fourth annual Bitcoin takeover.
Fourth annual Bitcoin takeover. Next week, it's going to be here at the Commons. There's a few events, or there's an event at University of Austin across the way, just catty corner of the Commons. But looking forward to it. A lot going on. I think we have 7 Bitcoin events, or actually 8 Bitcoin events and 6 days, 5 or 6 days. So I think you were part of the, you were here already in Austin for the first takeover, but Bitcoin takeover is something that we really started when we launched the Commons. And historically, South by Southwest, despite being a big technology in addition to film and music festival, doesn't ever include Bitcoin as a track. And given the absence of Bitcoin at South by Southwest here in Austin, it was appropriate for us to host the Bitcoin takeover of South by Southwest to give Bitcoin its due. And so the first one was in 2022, and we've hosted it every year since, continues to get better and continue to expand it. So it'll be next week, March 11th to the 15th. 15th. Well, we added on a film screening. So in South by Southwest, in honor of South by Southwest, which is a technology, film, and music festival, we've got a whole series of events. So the 11th, Nifty and Bitcoin Plus Plus are hosting a hackathon here at the Commons. And then the evening of the 11th, we are hosting a Bitcoin Not Blockchain event. Myself and Drew Bonsall will be giving a presentation to help educate all of the people that either believe that crypto is valuable or blockchain is valuable, to help understand what Bitcoin is, why it's blockchain is the only blockchain of relevance, and why blockchain is not tech. And then, so that's the 11th Tuesday. Wednesday, we're hosting an event here with HRF called The Great Divide, Bitcoin versus CBDCs, really highlighting that there are two paths forward, either a panopticon with mass surveillance of CBDCs, that's the natural way that the fiat world is going, or the open monetary system, closed versus open, centralized versus decentralized. So that'll be with HRF on Wednesday the 12th. And then Thursday the 13th, Pleb Labs hosting their startup day that has their top builder finale on the 13th. And then we'll have Austin Bit Devs that evening, where the winner of Pleb Labs top builder will be announced. And then on Friday, we'll have our main event, which is our full day of speakers. People can find out about it at bitcointakeover.org if they're interested in coming. It's a high signal day. We have 10 founder CEOs giving presentations on what they're building around Bitcoin, covering education, custody, financial services, insurance, payments, lightning infrastructure, mining infrastructure, demand response, and oil field mining. So we'll have representation from Upstream Data. Steve Barber's going to be there speaking. Michael Goldstein from Satoshi Nakamoto Institute. On the open source side, we'll have Mike Schmidt, founder and executive director of Brink. I'll be giving a talk on Zaprite and payments. We have the co-founder and CTO from Lightspark, Kevin Hurley, coming to talk about Lightning and what they're building at Lightspark. Drew Bonsall will be giving a talk. Becca Rubenfeld from AnchorWatch will be giving a talk. Mark Suman from Open Secret will be giving a talk. A few others. So that'll be Friday. That's the main event. It's a full day. Each speaker will give a presentation, which I think it worked really well last year, which is why we're replicating the format this year of being able to hear from 10 different founders and CEOs talking about what they're actually building, followed by 10 minutes of Q&A. And then on Saturday, we're actually doing a film screening. It was a late addition to the program, but we're doing a film screening of Elena Medievia's Dirty Coin, talking about Bitcoin mining and how it can help fix energy problems all over the world. So I've only seen an extended kind of 17-minute clip of it, so I'm excited for that. But yeah, it's going to be a great whole week and really showcase not just the Bitcoin community, but what's actually being built on and around Bitcoin. So anybody that's interested with all the crypto stuff that's going on in DC now and over the coming weeks, the Bitcoin Takeover week in Austin will be a full high signal series of events. What's your view? I mean, you've been at each of the takeovers. You're a big part of the takeover. I left out one big part, which is we're going to be doing a live TFTC after the speakers, which we did last year.
Let's give Danny the props. Live TFTC, what Bitcoin did crossover.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting.
It is. I'll be talking to Danny behind the scenes. No, I mean, it's my favorite event of the year. It's high signal. It's a long day, but it's a high signal, jam-packed day. And the caliber of people we get in the commons on that day has been high. And I think the bar has been set high and we're keeping it high. And I think juxtaposed to South by Southwest, it's really important that we do this here because Bitcoin does not get the lip service doesn't get the respect. No, I mean, and you were looking through for the headliners. The headliner this year is like Chelsea Clinton. Like it's completely.
It's like David Duchovny, Chelsea Clinton, and three people that you've never heard of.
Yeah. I like David Duchovny.
Well, I mean, it's not like I don't like David Duchovny, but...
But it's gotten far away from its roots of supporting, like Twitter was announced at South by Southwest back in 2005, 2006, whenever that was. And today it's like Chelsea Clinton's the lead.
Yeah, I'm actually writing a short piece on the takeover that I'll get out tomorrow, but that talks about the roots of South by really being a creative, you know, an indie music festival originally. Austin's live music capital world kind of expanded out to film, and it was a music and film festival, very, you know, indie focus and creative focus. And then it shifted to technology, and I don't want to say shifted, but it expanded to technology and it used to do cool things. And then that technology piece started to dominate and overshadow all of the really soulful things about South by Southwest. And now we kind of live in a world where that technology piece still tends to dominate South by Southwest, but even that has lost its luster because, you know, it's one thing to launch Twitter at South by. It's another thing for just big tech companies that can pay large fiat checks.
Did you walk down Congress yet today?
No.
The UAE city state of Dubai has their own space that they're setting up. It's literally just Dubai on it. Yeah. On, I think like third in Congress.
So I'm hopeful that South by will find its way back to its roots. And in the interim, and it's also that it's purposeful that they don't include Bitcoin. People submit Bitcoin tracks. So the way it works, people submit talk ideas and then South by Southwest selects it. And people always submit Bitcoin talks and they always pass it by. And so their loss is our gain. And, you know, I have, you know, a vision that maybe for South by to make it, they'll have to turn it into a Bitcoin conference.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
We have been doing it. We're going to continue to do it.
But really it is, I consistently get that it's the highest signal single day that people attend. And that, and because we've each of the past three years continue to raise the bar, creates a little stress to continue to raise it higher and higher. But there is no ceiling.
There isn't a ceiling.
There's no top because there is no bottom to fiat.
There's no top.
There's no top to the takeover. So check it out, bitcointakeover.org for anybody interested. Or if you're following me on Twitter, you've probably seen, but get your tickets because we're going to sell out this week.
They're going fast. And I think a lot of what we try to do at the takeover is shift the Overton window towards the signal in Bitcoin. Like, what's actually happening? What are people building? A lot of the topics that don't get tick in the mainstream and may not be the mainstream narratives that are being put forth by many who are viewed by the public as the supreme advocates of Bitcoin. I think that's why we're here to talk mainly today, is this recent piece that you wrote, Bitcoin is Money and Currency, from First Principles Logic, like you like to do, and just get down, identify a hang up somebody has with Bitcoin, and then you spend the time really digging into your mind and getting back to the base layer of an argument, and then building up from first principles, explaining why Bitcoin is or is not a certain thing. And I think I texted you and we talked about it on Saturday when we were at Matt's. This is one of the best pieces you've read in some time, because it's a problem that I didn't even realize, like the distinction between commodity, money, and currency. Never really thought through who actually defines that, or what defines that distinction, and how has it been recognized in the market to date. And you were explaining that you've run into this question a couple of times, and that you had the same sort of, I've never thought about this before. And so that's what set you out to write this paper.
Yeah, it, you know, and I didn't intend it to, I guess when I started writing it, I didn't really think that it was going to be as fundamental as it was, but I had recorded a podcast, I think it was with Daniel Prince, and he had asked, I can't remember how long ago it was, but he had asked me, you know, what's the difference between currency and money? And I didn't really understand the question, but I'm on a podcast, so I have to answer it. And at that time, I didn't really understand the distinction. I kind of understood the broader distinction in the context of money and currency in history, but I hadn't thought very deeply about the distinction in the context of Bitcoin or why it was a subject of debate, really. And so, however I answered the question is probably ridiculous in hindsight, because it wasn't really getting at the true nature of the question. And then since then, from a policy discussion standpoint, and while I'm somebody that's always vocal and advocating for Bitcoin and contributing where I can in the background of providing advice, I have resisted being part of an advocacy, formal advocacy part, group, just because there's so much noise, particularly in DC, that it just feels like you're swimming upstream so much, and that there's this concerted effort from crypto and blockchain special interests to lump everything together. And, you know, some of the context which got me thinking about it more was Michael Saylor, who's somebody that I have a lot of respect and appreciation for. You know, he's a great advocate of Bitcoin. He would describe Bitcoin as money and property, but then he would expressly say that it's not currency. And I was trying to understand what his view was of around those definitions. And as I started thinking about it more, and then as the Trump administration came in and appointed David Sacks as crypto czar, I had written a piece about a month ago talking about how it feels like the crypto blockchain craze was dying its slow death and was on the brink of fading away. And this just reinvigorated this ultimate negative consequence to Bitcoin. Everything's good for Bitcoin in the long term, but there can be negative consequences in the short term of recharging this conflation of everything.
And the confusion around that conflation.
And the confusion, because 100%, if people get sold a narrative around blockchain tech or crypto or all the utility, all these crypto scams are going to bring, it is definitionally harder for them to understand Bitcoin. And if I were to take somebody from zero and help them understand, build them up from zero to help them understand Bitcoin, I can get them there fairly quickly. But if somebody's wrapped their head around and become convinced of some blockchain narrative or some crypto, there's going to be 1,000 different currencies, it is definitionally, quantitatively, qualitatively harder to help that person understand Bitcoin.
It's 10x harder to refute bullshit than it is to put it out in the world.
Yeah, and especially once somebody has become convinced of something and then has taken a bunch of different actions with those incentives, they actually have an incentive not to understand. And it's not the same as whatever the quote is where somebody's job is dependent on it, so therefore they don't understand it. It's not the same way as the Cantillon effect. But if somebody's become convinced that all this crypto nonsense is tech and blockchain's tech, then, and they've gone out and started speaking about that, then they don't want to be wrong. There's an inherent bias to not want to hear an opinion that runs counter, or logic and reasoning that runs counter. And so as the conversation in DC has quote heated up, and as that has recharged this conflation of the two, there is a lot of people trying to influence policy in DC. And I think that it, in the long term, I think, you know, certainly Michael Saylor means well, but there are other people that don't mean well, that want to define, you know, Bitcoin a certain way and create a market structure to allow for, basically to codify and legitimize what I view as detrimental. And I don't come at this from a perspective that the free market shouldn't sort itself out, but it's also better for somebody to be able to be clear-minded around Bitcoin and not set policy for Bitcoin conflating all these things together. Because what happens in that world, from my perspective, is that if you lump Bitcoin in with everything else, then the snake oil is always snake oil. And when it becomes clear to everyone that it's snake oil, they're going to associate it with Bitcoin, and then they're going to overregulate Bitcoin, or they're going to put Bitcoin in a regulatory box that it shouldn't be in. And that, you know, again, while everything is good for Bitcoin, in the end, it can make people's lives harder in the United States. It can certainly make people's lives harder that are working on Bitcoin. And so I think it's important that people get it right. And that's what prompted, like, I think there's a, I guess I wrote it before Trump came out with his shitcoin stockpile, but there's an event in DC at the White House that David Sacks is organizing on crypto, like a crypto, I don't know what they're calling it, crypto summit or crypto working group on Friday. And then there's another event on Monday. And so I do think that it's important, not just to get ahead of it, but to frame Bitcoin correctly. We've had podcasts before where we talked about the importance of framing Bitcoin correctly and not seeding the ground. Because if it turns out, if you're just kind of towing the line, then eventually people are going to figure out what it is. And it's better to set good policy on the front end and not to run away from it. So in the piece, Bitcoin is current or money and currency, I specifically laid out the case for why it's both, and why, just from a fundamental economic perspective, because of the way that Bitcoin works, it can't not be currency, such that if it were to be put, if people tried to put it in a regulatory box or bucket that doesn't fit the substance of what it is, that will ultimately be detrimental, at least to the people that are here in the United States.
Sup, freaks? Do you have a credit card? Are you getting cash back or airline points or points for some other service? Guess what? Those are shit coins. You want to be stacking Bitcoin. And I have some groundbreaking news for you. The team at Fold has finally released the Bitcoin Rewards credit card. They have a wait list. Going to be distributing the cards later this year. So you want to get on the wait list. Fold Plus members are going to get unlimited 2% Bitcoin back on this credit card. If you get on the wait list, they're up to $200,000 in prizes they're going to be given out. So get on it as quickly as possible. Go to tftc.io/fold and get on the wait list there. If you're on the wait list, you have the potential to win some of the prizes. Check it out. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself, who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20. That is the frustrating thing about the framing of Bitcoin by many people trying to, what's the word I'm looking for, mold policy around Bitcoin, is just this pussyfooting around the fact that Bitcoin is money, number one, and is currency as well. And I think as an industry, we need to rip the Band-Aid off, particularly with the Trump administration, the way their posturing and the way the broader lobbying from the broader crypto industry is towards creating a distinction between Bitcoin and stablecoins, and really trying to say that Bitcoin is this digital gold store value asset that is a reserve asset for companies, individuals, countries, potentially even, and it helps embolden stablecoins, which they play together. And I'm still trying to understand the logic of that connection, but this is how it's being framed. I can certainly see how many people think that Tether's involved with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. They're stacking Bitcoin, and the demand for stablecoins drives demand for treasuries. And I guess the logic is that people are using the stablecoins to trade Bitcoin, but that's like the extent of the connection. There's this weird, I'm not sure if you feel this way too, but it feels like the way stable coins juxtaposed to Bitcoin are being framed from the big crypto lobbyist is they're sort of symbiotic. And I think there is a clear delineation between them.
Yeah. And so I think the, because one of the big competing priorities in Washington, D.C., or there's three big competing priorities. There's stable coins. There's this concept of market structure that will try to create regulatory clarity of
locking up tokens,
not just stable coins, but all the crypto grift and Bitcoin. And then there's another priority, which is the strategic Bitcoin reserve that Cynthia Lummis, senator from Wyoming, has a proposed bill for and is trying to work that through the legislative process. And so there's constituents that really want stablecoins to be the priority. There's other constituents that really want market structure to basically legitimize crypto altcoin scam world. And then there's a constituency that's trying to focus on Bitcoin. And within the three buckets, it's generally saying, trying to label, okay, Bitcoin's a commodity. There's this thing called a digital assets, which is all the crypto grift. And then there's stablecoins, which are currency. Or digital currencies. And the distinction, just for people's context, and this was something that I didn't, from a definitional standpoint, have as great of appreciation for, say, a year ago that I do now, because most people, and I talk about this in the piece that I wrote, most people, if you were to ask them what's the difference between money and currency, they would look at you kind of cross-eyed. They'd think that you're being pedantic and saying, what do you mean? The dollar is money and it's currency. Money and currency are two interchangeable words. And from a practical perspective, that's true. From a legal and regulatory perspective, and in the context of the history of money, there is a distinction, and the distinction matters from a regulatory perspective. And so just to kind of spell out that distinction for folks, it is that historically, say if you had a commodity money like gold, gold was money, and gold needed some currency to sit on top of it. And that currency came in the form of coinage, typically tied to the state or the crown. And then in the fiat world, similarly, initially, when the dollar emerged, gold was money, and the dollar was a paper note that essentially served as a contract that was convertible to gold. And so prior to Bitcoin, money historically wasn't always commodities, but commodities emerged as the best form of money. But then the currency sat on top, and the currency always had an issuer that was typically the state. Now, history of the United States, there were private monies and banks could issue private dollars.
Scrip, companies would issue money.
Yeah. But that distinction between money and currency is distinguishing between the underlying, say, commodity money like gold, and then the formal currency that needed to set a weight and measure and actually issue, convert, or, you know, if you were thinking about it from a coinage perspective, the process of refining gold into a coin served an actual tangible, valuable process in converting the commodity into a currency to make it a utility in trade. Not only setting a weight and measure, putting it into a standardized unit, validating it, enforcing against counterfeit. And so historically, there's a good reason to distinguish between the two. The thing about Bitcoin that makes it so unique in the history of money is that it is a commodity in the sense that a commodity would be traditionally defined, but it's also useful as money. And because Bitcoin, the network itself, is able to collectively, as I would frame it, issue money, like issue the 21 million, control the supply schedule, control how that 21 million is issued, enforce the fixed supply of 21 million, validate all currency transactions, transmit currency transactions. Like, you do not need the US dollar system to transmit Bitcoin transactions. The Bitcoin network facilitates all of that in a closed loop. And because Bitcoin has a baked-in native unit, it can do all of the things that any other currency that would otherwise need an issuer to do without an issuer. And so bringing back that to this bucket of, well, what's a commodity and what's a digital asset and what's a digital currency? It's like, yes, Bitcoin is a commodity, but it's also money and it's also viable as a currency. And trying to distinguish and say this is a commodity but not a currency is swimming upstream for fundamentally what it is from an economic standpoint. And the economic gravity will dictate that it will be used as such. And the only, we can kind of like go into some of those specifics of kind of what the roles that issuers have played and how Bitcoin helps eliminate it. But the consequence, if you follow logic through, is that the only reason to have another currency sitting on top of Bitcoin when Bitcoin can operate perfectly functionally as a currency system is to restrict its use. And I'm not saying, like, absolutely, I don't believe that anyone who understands Bitcoin, most notably Michael Saylor, that thinks it should be defined as a commodity and not as a currency. I don't think he's, you know, he doesn't have that incentive at all, nor do I think that is what his aim is. I'm saying that the consequence of creating these two distinctions, that's the logical end game. And so that's not only the logical end game, but it creates a consequence for anybody who's interacting with Bitcoin, not just as money in a store of value, but as currency.
Yeah. And it's funny, as I've read the piece and as I'm listening to you describe it now, I'm thinking back to one of the big memes, particularly in the early years, that people would run with to try to define Bitcoin as this incredibly innovative technology that represents a breakthrough in human history and this triple entry accounting. And it feels like particularly going back to the issuer and trying to account for the validation of transfers of the currency within a system, like this explanation that you're describing should be an add-on to that meme of triple entry accounting. Like it allows us to have this enclosed system that does everything from issue the money, control the issuance, validate what's being sent where, when, and then act as a unit of account as well.
Yeah. So, you know, if I just frame, say, the role of an issuer historically in money, thinking about, well, you know, in the context of gold, and I always try to reinforce people that you don't have to understand why gold was money to understand Bitcoin, but the dollar's origin was gold. And even if people don't understand gold, they can at least appreciate that gold, the gold standard existed, and that the entire world, whether they understand why or not, the entire world converged on gold as a monetary standard. But in order for gold to be functional as money, gold is an element. It's a rock in the ground. You got to get it out of the ground. You got to actually get the gold ore out of larger rock. Then in order to turn it into a coin, there's a metallurgical process to get the gold out of the rock ore. But then there's another chemical process and a refining process to turn this raw material into a shiny gold coin that isn't a standard weight and measure that says that this is a 1 ounce gold coin. And 1 ounce might have emerged on the market, but it was set by an issuer. It was set by somebody who's doing the refining. And for money to be viable as currency, you need standard weights and measures. And it's of no small consequence that Bitcoin removes that need for setting standard weights and measures. Not only did gold need some issuer to set standard weights and measures, but the dollar also needed someone to set standard units and measures. A penny, a nickel, a dollar, a $5 bill, a $20 bill, a $10 bill, a $100 bill. Now in the digital world, the dollar less so needs a standard unit, but it does need an issuer of currency and somebody to validate currencies. And that idea of triple entry accounting, however you might want to think about it, it's that there's this closed loop, truly autonomous system that can validate all currency transactions, and that you don't have to trust another third party. In the current iteration of fiat currencies, and the reason why an issuer is necessary in the context of all digital fiat currencies, whether it's a stable coin or that sits on top of the US dollar or the Fed's system itself, the Fed is ultimately the one that validates all currency transactions. The Treasury is the one that prints dollars and ensures that someone's not running around with a counterfeit bill or printing counterfeit bills and getting them into the currency supply. That is 100% a system that's based on trust, dependent on trust to work, dependent on trust and an issuer to work. And the thing that allows Bitcoin to operate without the issuer is this record system that is immutable, that relies on no third party to be a source of truth, that anybody can validate the currency and anybody can send it, because the process of actually sending, if you think about a bank transfer from one bank to the next, banks can't do that one-to-one. Now, a bank could take a $100 bill and walk it over to the other bank without a central third party, but they're dependent on ultimately the Fed for clearing those transactions.
Clearing system, yeah.
That's another place where, you know, it's like there is this autonomous accounting system that tracks all of these records and forces all of these records. And when someone's ready to transmit, the Bitcoin network handles that directly. It doesn't need to transmit, quote, through a massive third-party intermediary or any third-party intermediary. So that is, you know, kind of on kind of like the unit level, in terms of the unit of measure, the sats or the Bitcoin, as well as this open record that, again, oftentimes for people that are new, I like to qualify that there's not just one Bitcoin blockchain. Everyone's maintaining the records themselves. Everyone's validating records themselves. When transactions are transmitted, it's passing around to every node that exists, and that all nodes need to maintain their own independent record, and that they're able to get to the consistent state of ownership because of the way that the Bitcoin network works. But that through that process also is what allows for the elimination of an issuer entirely from the process. So I do agree, and it's an extension of this idea, and it's part of what allows it to operate perfectly from a technical perspective as a currency system without an issuer. That kind of idea of a triple entry accounting.
Sup, freaks. Bitcoin is the ultimate scarce asset. Join Bitcoin macro expert Nick Bhatia at a live online event on March 17th for death, taxes, and 21 million. Learn how to shield your wealth, leverage tax-advantaged accounts, and secure your Bitcoin for future generations. Your financial advisor, accountant, or attorney might not be up to speed on Bitcoin, so invite them to join too. Register now at unchained.com/TFTC. That's unchained.com/TFTC. March 17th, be there.
Again, it's a shame that it's your explanation of Bitcoin as currency. And again, going back to people really don't understand this. You didn't even understand it. I didn't understand it until you wrote the piece. And then it was like, oh, crap, there are these very minute details that matter for definitions, particularly when people are trying to put Bitcoin into a bucket at the government layer of society and erect regulatory frameworks around it. And I think it's crucial that we are as clear as possible when it comes to defining Bitcoin at the government level, particularly here in the United States. Obviously, we're Americans. This is what we care about. And I do worry that the noise that exists in DC could create a situation where it gets wrongly defined because people don't understand it, or others are trying to muddy the waters about what Bitcoin actually is for their own incentives and their own gain in the long run. And I think that extension of triple entry accounting is a good way to frame it to people that are trying to understand this or trying to pitch it to others out there.
As well as the significance of it, the significance of this entirely autonomous system that isn't dependent on a central third party to coordinate any of the functions that have historically been necessary to have a...
There's been a division of labor amongst all these...
To make a currency system work, and that doesn't exist in Bitcoin, and there are consequences to that. And yeah, one other thing that I want to make clear is that Bitcoin doesn't need any advantages to succeed. People building Bitcoin companies don't need any advantages to have their... We don't need special treatment. Bitcoin is what it is fundamentally. And the regulation is going to need to fit it. Otherwise, it's like governments can create bad policies and constituents can be harmed by those bad policies. Eventually, the quote regulation is going to fit the economic reality because it's a gravitational force. But in the intervening period, a lot of pain can be created. And that's what I think is important to avoid. And that what I believe is logical, not, I think it is an indirect consequence. If you define the consequence of incorrectly defining Bitcoin, if you define it as a commodity and say it's expressly not as a currency, and then it is not, we don't need the government to have an SBR for Bitcoin to succeed and all the individuals who are owning Bitcoin to have their number go up. We also don't need all capital gains to be removed from Bitcoin. From like good economic policy would be that all governments should hold Bitcoin and you should remove capital gains from Bitcoin, but Bitcoin doesn't need that. It doesn't need that advantage to succeed. by having bad policy, again, you can slow things down and make certain people's lives harder. That's fine and well. The big risk is as soon as you define it as it is this thing and it's not that thing, it is commodity and it is not currency, and then the dollar continues to degrade as a currency system. Price of beef at the grocery store when I went last week was up another 10%. That is happening because of gravitational force. As people begin to realize that the economic reality is that, and I'll walk through the logic, not because I want this to happen, just because it is, again, the economic reality. It either is or isn't. This isn't my opinion. Is that Bitcoin is competing with the dollar. I don't believe that's a bad thing. I can understand people's perspective that it is. My view is that it's not, and we made that case on another podcast. But it is competing with the dollar, and people are sending currency transactions. I'm working on Bitcoin payments. I'm helping everyday people every day. You know, ranchers, doctors, lawyers, shop owners, not just people working on Bitcoin.
People who run media empires.
You know? People that run media empires like TFTC accept Bitcoin's payment. And so if you've defined this as a commodity and not a currency, and then there's increasingly this trend of people using it as currency, and at the same time that the dollar is losing its value, which is one of the basis for Bitcoin to be a store of value, and that as everyone's doing that, then it becomes natural for them just to move the money between each other because it's the best form of money. Somebody comes along and says, I don't want you doing that. I don't want you transacting in Bitcoin. That's a commodity. It's not a currency. We were told it's not a currency. You can't use it as such. And so just reinforcing for people, it's not, this isn't important to try to get a policy that advantages Bitcoin. It's important not to make a misstep that can come back to haunt you later on. Let's just call it what it is.
Today, call spade a spade.
Let's call a spade a spade, and let's have a direct conversation about it and hopefully create good policy that does allow Bitcoin to flourish and doesn't slow it down.
And I think we went over this when we recorded the episode about combating the Fed, that Bitcoin does not compete with the US dollar. It does compete with the dollar. And
yeah, and let me explain this, because I have this lot. I lay out the logic in the piece, and you can find it at gradually then suddenly.xyz. It's also on Twitter, a Twitter article.
And TFTC.
And TFTC. Thank you for helping syndicate as the media empire in the room. But I'll walk through all of logic, but I'll start at this point because it's where we were, which is you can't store the same value in two different currencies at once. You can store different value in different currencies, and you can choose what percentage of your value you store in one versus the other, but you have to choose which you're storing value in. And that is the, there's no fundamental way around those. Like when you get paid either for your good or service directly, or if you're an employee, you get your paycheck, you have to decide, say you get $5,000 a month. You have to decide, do I want to save 1,000 of that in Bitcoin, 2,500 in Bitcoin, 5,000 in Bitcoin, and then you have to decide what you want to do with the rest of it. But you can't store the $5,000 in Bitcoin and fiat currency at the same time. And this idea of having kind of a fiat currency sitting on top of Bitcoin, even in that world, you have to choose. Because there is something fundamentally different, even if you're using a custodian. It would be fundamentally different if you were to deposit $5,000 into the Bitcoin exchange and have a liability of the exchange, like a deposit that's denominated in dollars, versus having a contract and a liability that's denominated in Bitcoin. If you deposited $5,000 into the crypto/Bitcoin exchange and it was a $5,000 dollar denominated liability, that is fundamentally different than you have X sats from a contractual perspective. And so Like, if you think about the history of gold, gold was convertible to dollars. You would put your gold in the bank and the bank would give you $20. The gold in the bank was the bank's. You now had the dollars. And there was a contract that said you could convert those dollars back to 1 ounce of gold. That contract was later broken in 1934 when the government devalued the dollar to 35-1. But it's this distinction of if you're trying to, like, you know, have this idea that you're going to save in Bitcoin and spend your dollars. Well, the first thing is, you know, as an example right now with the ETF, you don't actually have Bitcoin. You have stock or some security in an exchange traded fund that has a claim on Bitcoin, but your asset is the claim on Bitcoin, not the Bitcoin itself. And even though IBIT's working on being able to allow you to take Bitcoin in kind, it's drawing this distinction that if you had this fiat currency sitting on top of Bitcoin, you could either live in a world where you actually own the Bitcoin directly and it's titled to you, or you could have a fiat currency that's convertible, or you could just hold a fiat currency that's free floating. But in any of those cases, you have to decide what percentage of the value you're saving in Bitcoin and what percentage you're saving in dollars. And Bitcoin, kind of like working back from the beginning of the logic, it's that Bitcoin has a credibly enforced fixed supply. It represents money that can't be printed. It's only credibly enforced because it operates entirely decentralized and not decentralization theater. Decentralization is not trivial. Bitcoin, as a function of that decentralization, is at the network level, is resistant to all forms of censorship. That's what allows it to be global and permissionless. And it's what allows the Bitcoin network to credibly enforce its fixed supply without the need of trust. The basis of Bitcoin storing value is its fixed supply. But again, its fixed supply is only credible because it's resistant to censorship. That's what allows you to permissionally, if you want to be able to plug directly into Bitcoin and transmit the currency without going through some outside system. And everyone in the world is incentivized to hold a form of money that can't be printed versus one that can. So if you think that you're just going to store your value and spend your dollars, that reality itself is predicated on you making a decision of storing a certain percentage of your wealth in one versus a certain percentage in the other, even just for that moment where you want to convert into it to send it. It was predicated on somebody else holding the dollars. And that's where it gets to, well, everyone will be in the future, is today, but just by the reality of it, very few people still understand Bitcoin. But in a world where everyone understands Bitcoin, who are all these dollar holders? Like, everyone, every time they're getting paid and taking dollars as currency, are having to decide what percentage stays in that versus not, and what might be converted to Bitcoin. And in the end, everyone, like to a person, is incentivized to hold Bitcoin, and everyone is incentivized to hold a maximum amount of Bitcoin, such that the only reason in that world where Bitcoin adoption grows and there's more people, if there's two Bitcoin holders on each side of a transaction that are willing to transact in Bitcoin directly for goods and services, the only reason why another currency system would need to sit on top would be because Bitcoin wasn't capable of facilitating the exchange on a direct basis, which it is capable of technically facilitating that, which then comes back to, well, if everyone's maximally incentivized to hold Bitcoin and it's capable of sending and transmitting currency transactions and processing for final settlement without a third party, the only reason to add a fiat currency into that equation would be unsolving the problem of why you originally opted into the form of money that can't be printed. And from a practical standpoint, the only reason for that to exist, again, would be to ban the transactional use, to police and exert control over who has access. And the other thing that I mentioned, and I'll pause because that was a long rant, but nothing about Bitcoin from a regulatory perspective, from a fundamental economic perspective, being money and being currency, prevents, say, the U.S. government from regulating its financial system. Those two statements are not incongruent. So that's one of the reasons why it's like, hey, just recognize that, treat it as currency, and it doesn't prevent you from regulating JP Morgan the way you want to regulate JP Morgan. It's a U.S. company that services U.S. individuals, and if they're interacting with Bitcoin and you want to regulate how an individual interacts with a financial institution or what obligations a financial institution has, that's fair game. But that sits at a different level than the regulatory treatment of Bitcoin itself.
Yeah. And this is the question I was at, one of the questions I was asked at Bitcoin Investor Week in New York, POMS conference on stage. And it was this whole debate about what is actually happening in Bitcoin. And the question he put forth was, does Bitcoin compete with the dollar? And I said, yes. And leaning exactly into this example that you're describing, we'll just give a tangible example with TFTC as a business. Like and before you even wrote the piece, this is how I described it. Like, does Bitcoin compete with the dollar? Yes. Every day as a business owner, I make the conscious decision. I look at the dollars in my bank account that come in through ad revenue and other revenue streams that we have. And I look at it like, how much money do we have? How much fiat expenses do we have in the next 15 to 30 days? How much cash do I want to keep in my bank account? And then I've run that calculation, and anything above that, that is excess cash in our bank account, I immediately sweep to Bitcoin. That example right there is the dollar competing with Bitcoin. I am making a conscious decision of, do I want to hold these dollars in my bank account or convert them to Bitcoin?
Yeah. And that's what people just have to accept at basically an atomic level, that every single person in the world, whether they're conscious of Bitcoin or not, is having to make a decision about what they store in dollars versus other assets. Just so happens that Bitcoin is actually money and viable as a currency system. So this dilemma becomes more of consequence, right? Because people in the traditional world will look at that same dilemma and say, well, I don't want to hold these dollars because I know that they're engineered to lose value. So I'm going to hold stocks, or I'm going to hold real estate. It's just that stocks and real estate aren't also money. And so the consequence of, or the perceived consequence of Bitcoin, quote, competing with the dollar is more significant because it's competing on a more direct level. It's competing as money. And that if people just accept at that atomic level, each time they're just deciding whether to convert X percentage into Bitcoin, that allocation, whether it's 5% or 10% or 20% or 50% or 100% into Bitcoin, they're being forced into that decision. They're making the decision by their actions every day. And if they ascribe or understand this path to why incrementally they're storing more of the value in Bitcoin and making that progressive decision to store less in the dollar, and if everyone around them is having to make that decision as more people figure out Bitcoin and it does have this fixed supply and that's better than the dollars that are losing their money, then, well, what happens when everyone has figured that out?
And you're going to love this. To extend the example further, using TFTC as an example, I told you Saturday when we were at dinner that I'd paid 3 Zaprite invoices that week. I got my 4th yesterday. Yesterday morning, I'm drinking my coffee, getting the news, bing, email comes, Zaprite invoice. And for this particular expense, it was the first Zaprite invoice that gave the option to pay in fiat using card or ACH or Bitcoin. And so going back to that thought experiment of how I run the business earlier, of I look at my fiat expenses, what I think I'm going to have to pay, how much cash I should keep in the bank account, how much fiat, and put the rest in the Bitcoin. This was the first of this particular expense that gave me the option to pay in Bitcoin or fiat. and the fiat had a 4% premium on it. If I want to pay fiat, it's 4% more. So I made the conscious decision there where I had the cash in my bank account expecting it to be a fiat expense at some point in the month. But the Bitcoin payment option was there, and I was like, I'm not going to pay 4%. So I just paid in Bitcoin and immediately bought the same amount because I was going to use that cash anyway to pay this expense.
Yeah.
And so
let's walk through that example, because that gets to another part of the logic that I articulate. And sometimes it can be hard for somebody to grasp it that is thinking about capital gains and is thinking about their own decision to store value in Bitcoin versus dollars. And one thing I would say to certain people,
before anybody calls bullshit on this, I have the receipts. I will share them if people want to ask for them.
Yeah. But, that for people that have, say, 5% of their money in Bitcoin and 95% in fiat, yeah, just spend the fiat. You've got more fiat than you have Bitcoin. What that also means is you're storing more of your value in the form of money that's losing its purchasing power than the form of money that's gaining in purchasing power, and that you're probably just underexposed to Bitcoin. But in your example, and this is something that I explain in the piece, that if there's two current, and I showed a diagram to this, if there's two people, there's holder of Bitcoin A and holder of Bitcoin B, and they're actually trading partners, somebody issuing you an invoice. If you both have Bitcoin and you are both willing to transact in Bitcoin, the cost of that transaction, irrespective of the capital gains, is cheaper. The transaction itself is cheaper if you just send that person Bitcoin, because it's just one transaction. You had Bitcoin, they wanted Bitcoin. Even if you didn't use the dollars, but you're running low on your working capital, and occasionally you have to convert Bitcoin back to dollars to facilitate the dollar currency transaction. In that case, had you done that, you would have had to convert Bitcoin to fiat. That's transaction one. You would have had to then send the fiat. That's transaction two. And the person on the other side wanted the Bitcoin, so they would have to convert the fiat to Bitcoin. So it's three currency transactions when one could have sufficed. It's three set of transaction fees, and fiat transaction fees are more. It's by definition inefficient. And so that is, I don't say fewer and far between, but given the fact that there are still few people, say 1 in 100 that understand Bitcoin, I would gather that it's less than 1 in 100 that really get it. But that's the prime example where that person on the other side wanted Bitcoin. They were able to communicate it to you by putting a 4% premium on Bitcoin. But
on cash.
Yeah.
On dollars.
On dollars. Yeah. Sorry, 4% premium on fiat. That you were able to affect one currency transaction rather than three. And that's the definition of efficiency. You're affecting the same work for less work, the same transaction for less work.
And a direct example that these two things compete.
Yeah.
Not only that, I paid the invoice over the Lightning Network on a Sunday morning, so that immediately settled in their account. There was no.
Because even if you had sent your dollars, you would have had to replenish it. And they would have had to say you sent the dollars to them. It was at minimum two, because they were going to convert it to Bitcoin. They had expressed their, they had expressed their preference that they wanted the Bitcoin. And so helping people understand that is a perfect example of two Bitcoin holders, one that has Bitcoin, one that wants to be paid in Bitcoin, and that it was used as currency. It is currency. That is the economic reality. You can't deny it. And that if you were to, by some regulatory or legal decree, try to prevent that behavior from happening, not only are you introducing an inherent economic inefficiency, but you're also trying to stop water from moving downhill. It's capable of being sent between peers. And in this dilemma where, 1 out of 100 people understand Bitcoin, there's going to be naturally fewer instances relative to the fiat world where there's a Bitcoin holder on either side of a real commerce transaction. But as that 1 out of 100 goes to 2 out of 100, goes to 3 out of 100, gets to 60 out of 100, and ultimately 100 out of 100, then it becomes very clear to everyone what the same economic reality is that you just described. And so even though it's not common every day, now when I say that, it's like people are facilitating Bitcoins more and more every day. So for them, it is functionally operating as currency transactions. But for people who can't understand that because they're not participating in it, it still doesn't change the economic reality. It's just harder for them to gather because of the adoption dynamics. But that will necessarily change as more people figure out that Bitcoin has a fixed supply and as fiat currency gets the base more and more.
Yeah. And I think that last point is really important. I tried to drive that home last week on the stage at the conference, is that it may not seem like it, like you may not experience these types of economic transactions in your daily life, but they are happening and there more will happen over time. And to your point, the fact that they are happening is a validation that Bitcoin is currency. Yes. And I think narrative wise, it's something we need to brainstorm in the industry, because that's nobody uses Bitcoin for money, as money. It's speculative asset, blah, blah, blah. You have Roger Ver, it's too expensive on chain, like, which isn't even true today. But like, bad example, yesterday morning, sitting at my coffee table, paid a $3,000 transaction over the Lightning Network, instantly settled, immediately rebought the Bitcoin plus a little bit because I was like, you know what? Let's buy a little bit more. I paid an invoice. I'm good to go.
Like, yeah. It's actually easier, and it's particularly easier if you can envision this future world where you're not constantly having to go in and out of currency transactions and exchange. But in a world where there's two Bitcoin holders on either side that are willing to trade in Bitcoin, going in and out of the fiat currency necessarily just makes a ton more friction. And so with that perspective, that is how the Bitcoin network itself operates and is able to coordinate trade between two counterparties without a currency issuer sitting in between. There can be intermediaries, like you might have used a non-custodial wallet or you might have used a custodian, but the Bitcoin went from address A to address B, and there was no third party that needed to say that currency transaction is good. It can now move on and be validated. The Bitcoin network itself did that on its own. Because that's the economic reality, the best policy would be to match what Bitcoin is with the appropriate regulatory framework. And that would incentivize innovation. It just doesn't need that to succeed. And for the people that, you know, get hung up on the tax treatment, it's like if the real thing that's holding Bitcoin back from being used day to day as a currency is more so that people don't understand Bitcoin. It's that dilemma of 1 out of 100 people understand it. If 20 out of 100 people understand it, there would be more than 20x the amount of Bitcoin payments, because there's a certain reality that you need density of Bitcoin adoption to allow for overlaps of I'm individual A paying individual B, I have Bitcoin, and individual B wants to receive Bitcoin. It's just a law of small numbers, and the law of large numbers will dictate greater density and more natural trade. So the tax treatment, the capital gains, is a source of friction. But Jack Mallers made this great point on one of his Money Matters podcasts, where he articulated that if you have a capital gain on a transaction, it just means that your money didn't get destroyed. So imagine if I got compensated in Bitcoin when it was 16,000, and say I got one Bitcoin, and I decided for some irrational reason to convert those to dollars at the time, I wouldn't have had any tax consequences. I would have just gotten $16,000. And then Bitcoin goes to $100,000, and I'm sitting on 16,000, and I have some good or service. Last year, I needed to get my transmission fixed, which was $10,000. Okay, I just spent $10,000 out of my $16,000. So now I've got $6,000 left. Well, if I had saved it in Bitcoin, and Bitcoin went to $100,000, and even if I needed to sell it back to fiat, but say, let's say the example was the guy was willing to take Bitcoin, $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, I have to sell 0.1 of a Bitcoin. I have to pay capital gains tax 20% on the difference of $10,000, the percentage that's between 16,000 and
100,000.
So I need to pay 20% on 80%, something like $2,000. Rough math. Well, how much money do I have left?
Yeah, 88,000.
Yeah. So 87.5.
Yeah.
0.875 of a Bitcoin versus 6,000 divided by 100.06 of a Bitcoin. That's functionally the dilemma. So if people are hung up on that capital gains, it is a friction, but it's more of a, I'd say,
it's velocity. A luxury friction.
It's a luxury friction. Yeah. And so once somebody understands that, and also this is not tax advice, but I did not know this. There's a $60,000 exemption on cap gains.
It's good to know.
Double check that. But I've had multiple tax advisors and financial advisors tell me that, but that none of that changes the fact that that economic reality is the same, that you're still incentivized to store more of your wealth in Bitcoin and spend the Bitcoin than you would be and pay the capital gains than you would be just being the bag holder.
Just holding dollars.
Yeah. But that's not really the thing that's holding back Bitcoin payments. It's more just needing more people holding it. And as more people hold it, then there will, by the density alone, be more natural occurrences of Bitcoin holders being on either side of a transaction. And so that's the reality. Now, if they were to remove capital gains as a policy, which in the piece I basically said, like, you don't need to define this is a commodity, this is a digital asset, which, by the way, digital asset itself is a grift, and stable coins. It's like, call Bitcoin currency. If you want to make the best policy, call it currency and take away the capital gains. And yes, the government should buy it, but just don't try to define it or put it into a box that doesn't fit.
Yeah. I think that's hard for people. And it's fascinating to me that it is hard for people, because particularly in the industry and particularly the people that are really hitting the pavement and beating the drum that Bitcoin isn't currency, doesn't compete with the dollar. It's like, you're also saying it's this incredibly innovative new technology, and you're trying to put it into these buckets of pre-existing frameworks where it's sort of those two ideas conflict directly.
Right. Yes. And there's just this natural thing that's left on, and people
it's just like, don't poke the bear too.
Well, that's part of it, but people on CNBC will ask Michael Saylor's interview today, but it was asked in a little bit of a different way. It's like, but what do you do with it? You just sit, it just sits there. Like, you know, if you describe this as the best store of value, but it's just this digital thing, it's a very esoteric point to just end at. Like, oh, everyone's just going to store value in this thing, and everyone's just going to store more value. And the logical connection of it is, well, no, because it's money and it's currency, and then you're going to use that thing called Bitcoin to buy food at the grocery store, gas at the gas station on a direct basis. That's the end state. If you don't have that logical end state, None of it makes sense. So we're all just holding this Bitcoin. It's all going up in value, but to what end? The currency piece of it is actually what helps it become more logical.
Yeah, and this was the piece you wrote right before this one, right? Is the it's like Schrodinger's money. Like Bitcoin only has value, the exchange theory of value.
Oh, that was two ago.
Yeah.
Different. That's a little bit of a different point, but my point I'm making here is more that
it confuses people, because people in the public, you're like, you're not going to do anything with it,
right? It confuses people if you, and it's not to say create a story for the sake of creating a story, but it's.
I just told you a real life example of this happening.
If you don't connect the logic, where like if your logic is, and we're all just going to hold Bitcoin and it's just going to exist and it's going to go up in value and there's going to be fiat currency. It's like, how does it just keep going up in value? It's like, well, it's going up in value because it's actually money, and money is used to coordinate trade. And in the end, people are actually going to be using this money to pay each other directly. That is actually logically coherent. Whether or not someone accepts it as the reality, that is at least logically coherent to paint a vision. Otherwise, it's just kind of the logic of, well, everyone's going to hold Bitcoin and no one's ever going to spend it. But it's just going to keep storing value for everybody. And that it's particularly confusing because it's not like the logic. It's not that the logic breaks down. It doesn't end at the point that it actually ends at, which is it's used as money to.
And you leave people confused because they can't draw that.
Yeah.
Since you're not drawing that distinction for them, or not even drawing it for them, but highlighting it to them, they get lost at that sort of, this sounds like a Ponzi scheme because everybody's going to buy it, store their value in it.
Right. Yeah. There's something missing. There's something very logically that is the true reality that's missing from the end of the.
And it fascinates me that people are so afraid to admit it. Like,
yeah, but I don't think it's so much afraid to admit it. I think that it's actually believing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that world can exist where you're just storing value and storing value in Bitcoin and spending your dollars.
Cynthia ran with this beam last week too.
Right.
Next
time I see her, I'll explain this directly, but that world can only exist where very few people hold Bitcoin and the majority of people hold dollars. But if for the same reason that you started to hold Bitcoin, if everybody figures that out and everybody's holding Bitcoin, then that reality can't exist.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating observing it as a business owner, that obviously we're a Bitcoin company. A lot of our counterparties in the space, whether it's advertisers, the commons, are Bitcoiners. But it's been like the last 6 months, like we're doing a design collab with Skylar from Finite Supply. He sent me his AppRite invoice. Like the amount of counterparties in this business, both sending invoices to and receiving invoices from, that have the option to pay in Bitcoin is increasing every month. Satoshi Pacioli, when I go to pay my monthly bookkeeping and accounting services, AppRite invoice, Bitcoin, boom. Like, and I can see it here personally, and this is a bit of an anomaly to the broader public because we are a Bitcoin company, but you see it every day, what you're doing. It's not just Bitcoin companies doing this.
Right. And that's a good point to help connect for people just on seeing this future vision. And I think it's important to articulate that Bitcoin is currency today, like from an economic atomic level. It's currency today. It's not
objectively
by every definition, historical or otherwise. You know, historical in terms of the context of how people have defined money, practically just in terms of how people interact with money. Bitcoin eliminates the issuer entirely from all the functions that an issuer previously played in the function of money. What it doesn't eliminate is you still need tools to interact with Bitcoin. You still need a computer. You need a hardware wallet. You know, those tools, you know, just because you need other tools to make the money a greater utility and a more effective currency doesn't mean that any of those tools that you need are reinserting an issuer into the equation, which is the critical piece between money and currency. On the payment side, the other thing that it needs is tools to help people facilitate Bitcoin payments. So that Zaprite, you know, like you said, an invoice. Well, we created an invoice to make it easy, not just to accept Bitcoin, but to accept fiat and Bitcoin side by side. But then we have a lot of things in that piece of software that help provide for you and for the person who sent you the invoice, the business context. You have the record of what you paid, not just the amount, but what you paid for, so that you can then do your accounting. We provide the Bitcoin to fiat accounting cost basis. All of those pieces just in the context of the invoice, and we, you know, have an API that does the same thing and a virtual point of sale and different payment templates. Those are building out Bitcoin as a currency system, putting tools in merchants and entrepreneurs and ultimately consumers' hands that allow them to functionally, like anybody can send Bitcoin to anybody else, but the world of payments necessitates combination of business context and the fulfillment of goods and services. Each one of those type of payments needs infrastructure to be built around it to make it not technically possible, because it's technically possible today, but functionally easy for a consumer and individual, or sorry, a consumer and a business. As more of those tools exist, it's like the tools have to exist for people to use them. People adopt the tools, and then more people use them. It's a iterative cycle. And that's another reality. It's like if people don't use Bitcoin as currency, then the tools won't get built to make it better. It is currency, so the economic gravity of the situation will dictate it, that it will, regardless of the economic friction that might be created by some regulatory apparatus. But the point remains that those tools still, you know, even if you've removed the issuer from the core of the currency system, you still need tools to be built to make payments practically adoptable for individuals and businesses. And in the future, Bitcoin's going to have to be built into every payment system, every bank, every, you know, again, every type of transaction, a real estate transaction, an oil transaction, a gas transaction, a grocery store transaction, a gas station transaction. That is actual work that has to be done in order, you know, if you want to pay for gas at the gas station, some people have to get together to build Bitcoin payments into the gas
meter.
Yeah. Right. So just understanding that it's a process, but none of that changes the fact that in the background, money is moving between counterparties without a central issuer, not needing a central issuer.
Yeah. Did you listen to the All In podcast with the Collison brothers yet? That we were talking about on Saturday.
I've heard multiple people have reached out to tell me about it,
but it's hilarious because you have, and the reason I bring it up is because right after I told you to listen to that, because I'd listened to it the week before, and they still have a fundamental misunderstanding of Bitcoin. They use the old tired trope, like, we implemented Bitcoin a while ago. Back then it was on-chain, before Lightning existed. Nobody's really using it. It was slow and expensive, and we believe that stable coins are going to be the currency of choice in the digital economy. Bitcoin really isn't a currency. And it was hilarious because, going back to that invoice I received yesterday morning, and they had a 4% premium on fiat payments, and I paid in Bitcoin, and then just spent and replaced immediately. And I talked to the person who sent me the invoice, and that's anybody who's sending Zaprite invoices. I haven't really done it yet, but it really was the kick in the ass just experiencing it yesterday in person. Put a premium on fiat because I saw that 4%, it was only 4%, and I was like, I'm paying in Bitcoin because I don't want to pay that. And I talked to the person who issued the invoice, and he's saying, yeah, because it goes to Stripe, and that's like around like the fee that they would charge us to process this transaction. And so you have the Collison brothers out there saying Bitcoin isn't really good for payments. And then yesterday I consciously decided to use it because the friction they introduce with their the fees that they charge was enough.
And particularly if you're sending large amounts.
Yeah. Like it was a $3,000 invoice.
Right.
Yeah.
They add up. I get paid, you know, $500 wire. I get a $500 wire from a sponsor of the Houston meetup, and I believe I get $465.
Holy shit.
My bank takes a $15 wire fee, and their bank takes a $20. It's like 7%, I think.
Yeah.
An interesting point about that, just connecting this idea, is that when we built that invoice for Zaprite, you can put a discount on it. You can put a discount on Bitcoin, or you can put a premium on fiat. That itself is a tool that had to be built. You know, a part of what allowed whoever sent you that invoice, without having to have a discussion with you, to say, you can pay me in either, but I want Bitcoin. And they didn't have to have a conversation. They just could put a premium on it. That the premium, the 4% premium, was like, if you want to pay me $3,000, you can either pay me $3,000 worth of Bitcoin, or you can pay me
$3,120.
Right.
I think,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Without having to have a conversation. That is a combination of power software, but then also a tool built that allowed economic incentives to eliminate a conversation between two peers to affect the transaction. And I haven't seen the All In podcast with the Collison brothers, but there was this, I don't know if you guys put notes in the show notes, it might not be worth it, but there was this funny, if this was
Logan, take notes.
I'm listening. I'm waiting.
There was one of those Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs used to do
product
great for all the Zoomers out there that don't remember Steve Jobs' great product pitches. He would, you know, deliver this beautiful new phone, you know, and it's in this auditorium and it worked. Because he was Steve Jobs. But all these tech founders try to replicate it, and they try to integrate his showmanship, but for products that just aren't nearly as significant. So one of the Collison brothers is up there talking about how they're integrating stable coins. And it's almost like a humiliation ritual. Obviously, he doesn't understand it, but he's talking about, we're going to use Solana, and I'm going to open up my Uniswap wallet, and has to reference all these different weird things about the shitcoin world. And he's like, I send it and watch, it's done. It's like, bro, like, these networks are like ephemeral things sitting on top of the dollar. The whole thing here is that fiat's getting debased. People call them stable coins, but they're just losing the same value that the dollar is losing. And eventually they're going to be worthless. But just the way he like went through the transaction and was like, and now it's just instant done, like done. I was like, man, when this guy figures out Bitcoin, he's going to be so embarrassed.
Right.
By
you're standing there like, I don't even know how to use Uniswap. Like he's explaining that use case, and as an end user, I'm like, okay, I've got to download Uniswap. And
well, I mean, not even that, I was like Uniswap, you're fucking around with that shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
well, think about this use case.
There were others that he mentioned, but it was just like thinking that was the innovation. And in my mind, not only do I know that the real innovation is Bitcoin, and again connect not for people. People can think that the friction to Bitcoin payments is capital gains taxes. It is, to an extent, it ranks like a distant third. The payment tools need to be created. The biggest thing limiting adoption of Bitcoin payments is Bitcoin adoption as a store of value, and as more people have it. But that the way I also think about all the, like, why the stablecoin stuff is noise, and people use them, so I'm not saying it's invalid. People in the Bitcoin mining space use it. I don't think it's interesting. It's going to have the same fate as fiat currency, but it's like a worse Venmo, where if you send Venmo, if you spent money on Venmo, money's not actually moving. If you send stable coins, like the only way that dollars actually move through the US banking system is through the Fed. And dollars aren't moving through the Fed. They're just, it's the equivalent of a Venmo transaction just within another closed network. You can think of it as open because, you know, different wallets can connect to it, but the actual dollars, if you want to get them into the banking system and then say, go spend them, at all the retailers that accept, because like literally they're functionally a worse form of dollars today. The best you can do is make them as good as the dollar, you know, basically the dollar equivalent, which they're not today. But then what you do between here and now is spend all this time in investment, and they bought one of my friend's companies. So good for Zach, you know, I'm happy for him, but you basically have to do all this work to make stable coins equal to the dollar, which is in the process of degrading and failing.
And I'm not being rude having my phone out. I went to check the transaction of the invoice I paid. $3,000 yesterday when I paid it was before the market pumped, so it was like 3.524 million sats, and the fee was 4,400 sats. So, and I just was doing the math, like a 12 basis point.
Did you pay on chain?
No, Lightning.
Okay.
Lightning, 12 basis point fee going through the Lightning network.
Yeah, and you got a $3,000 Lightning transaction that
went through like immediately.
Yeah,
and settled in their wallet immediately.
That's the definition of economic efficiency.
Yeah. And instead of paying $120, I paid.
And part of this also to connect for people is, because it is multi-layered, that if you have two people that want Bitcoin on either side, there's an efficiency because it's just one transaction versus three. But also the reason why there's this gravitational force that will force Bitcoin to be used as currency is that transaction, and transaction fees will fluctuate as more value is delivered by parties, they're going to need to be paid for that. But the transaction itself is trustless. And Lightning, let's call it trust minimized. But even in that context between you and your peer, functionally speaking, you couldn't get that Bitcoin back. It was gone. And there didn't need to be a central third party in between. So the transaction is not just more efficient because there was one transaction that was effective versus three. It was more efficient because Bitcoin's a trustless system that itself is able to move value between parties more efficiently than introducing trust. And then that trust is a more arcane process of validation that requires more infrastructure and work and more risk, because the Stripe fees are so high because they're taking credit risk. There's risk of chargebacks. There's risk of fraud. And somebody's paying for that. The system's paying for that. In a currency system that's 100% built on trust, everything is credit. But when you can push a payment that is funded and that can't be taken back, that's also a part of this efficiency gain. The other side of it that people might be thinking about or wondering is like, well, then the price of Bitcoin went up. It's like, it's not just such as life. It's that imagine a world where you had 100% of your savings in Bitcoin, that you were maximally exposed to Bitcoin. Going back to that example, like if I had taken payment in dollars at 16,000 and just sat in dollars versus converted all to Bitcoin and then had to deal with the currency consequences. Imagine you only, in that same example, imagine I only had Bitcoin, I only had that one Bitcoin, the 100,000, and I had to spend the $10,000 because I needed to fix the transmission of my car, which was necessary to my life. If Bitcoin doubled, it doesn't matter. I needed the car fixed, and I still have 90% of my savings, you know? And in reality, when you're spending your Bitcoin, if you have virtually all of your savings in Bitcoin, which is someone like myself does, and you, not to out you, but I know you well enough, is that it doesn't matter if it goes up, because when you're spending Bitcoin, you're spending like a very, very small fraction. And then you're working to get more Bitcoin, you know, like it's just that's trade reality of economics. You have certain needs and wants, And it doesn't matter if the price goes up if you have virtually all your money in it because you're spending a small fraction of it. Yeah, it doesn't make sense if you only have 5% of your money in Bitcoin and 95% in fiat. Yeah, sure. Spend some of your fiat, but you have too much fiat too.
Yeah. In this example, it'd be better if the price didn't crash down to where it was before the pump yesterday.
Oh, I see.
At the time of recording.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, for but
the
a period,
same the same example I just described would have been better, but yeah. Like then
for,
you're just
for like a period of 20 hours, like I paid that invoice and then it was literally I paid that invoice immediately rebought plus some what I would have saved on the what I did save by not paying a fiat and having to stomach those Stripe fees. Like I paid and rebought, so I was back to I was back above where my Bitcoin balance was before I did the payment, and the person received the payment like. For a period of time in the last 24 hours, they were up 10% on that. So they had $3,300 worth of value at one point.
Yeah. And what I would say is like, none of that really matters.
No.
Right. Like if, again, imagine illustratively you have 100% of your savings in Bitcoin. It's like you had an invoice to pay and you're going to get paid in Bitcoin in the future. And if you're endeavoring in your business as you should be, it's like, I got to be spending fewer Bitcoin than I'm making for this economic activity to make sense. And the part that ties it together, because someone might be sitting there thinking like, well, if it goes up, certainly there was a consequence to that. And like, yeah, you have to make economic decisions. Do you want to consume or do you want to save? And maybe not all good, you know, consumption decisions are good. And you should have saved rather than consumed. And in business, you can endeavor to make investments that don't pay off. If you're minded to consume on only the things that you really need, and if in business you're endeavoring to produce things of value, then as you're spending Bitcoin, as it's going up, you should be doing that with the mind that you would only pursue that activity to make more Bitcoin. And this, and the piece that you mentioned that I had written before on the exchange theory of money, it's that value is actually created through exchange. So in that example, it's less so that the, you know, between you and your peer, someone has the Bitcoin. You know, someone has the, how many sats?
3.5 million.
So the value went up, the value went down. For one of you, it's up. For the other one, you went down. But you paid someone to do a service.
It's vital to my business.
That's vital to your business. He got paid as compensation. And your business is generating Bitcoin. That's how value is created. Value is created through trade. You needed somebody with some specialized skill to do a part of your value chain so that you could deliver services to all of your consumers, the podcast listeners, the readers of the TFTC media empire.
We shouldn't laugh at it. It is an empire.
It is. It is. But... That's how value is created through money. Money is coordinating trade. It's not zero sum. The guy who got the Bitcoin that you paid, he got the money. You got the service. You sell that service to people, you get more Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You know, that's not zero sum is the point. The more that that happens, the more that Bitcoin is used as currency, that is how it derives value. It doesn't mean that Every value transfer that Bitcoin helps affect is how value is created, even if you're using dollars and intermediaries. I'm just connecting for people that it's not zero sum. Like the same sats exist. One person has it, you don't, but you're destined to get more sats by delivering a great service. And through that operation, more value is created for more like, what's the term? More economic benefit. It actually expands. It doesn't remain static.
Positive EV.
Yeah.
And we'll be able to talk about this more openly at the Bitcoin takeover.
Wonderful. Cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So go get your tickets, freaks.
Yeah, get the tickets to Bitcoin takeover, bitcointakeover.org. Yeah, it's going to be an amazing day, capped off by the live TFTC, what Bitcoin did, but really spans across every facet of Bitcoin. I don't think I missed any or we missed any in the program. So
no. I hope this real world example helped to articulate this point. About that on the go. I think it's important too.
It is to help someone. Cause I can, on the currency and money question, I hope people kind of come away with a better understanding of the distinction. And from a practical perspective, it can seem pedantic, but it's currently being debated in Washington, D.C., and there will be consequences. So I hope people come away with just a better distinction of that. But then I can also appreciate how people can get hung up on, not necessarily, well, what's the point, but there seems to be so much friction, so why even elevate this as something that needs to be debated? And it's because of what Bitcoin is at its nature, and because people are really using this, and that the more that people use it, the more effective the tools will get, the greater the economic efficiency. And then, you know, in the end, that Bitcoin will be able to be a working economic system for more people and help end this fiat calamity. You know, it doesn't end without tools to exist to affect commerce. And the more people that use those tools, the more people that get a Zaprite invoice and pay it, or, you know, pay somebody with BTC Pay or any service, that the more people that use those tools and understand like this layered thinking of like, don't get hung up by the capital gains, don't get hung up on the accounting. It's like, use it. The more that you do, the better the tools will get. And that's how we actually get out of this conundrum.
Well, thank you for building the tools. And honestly, like Zaprite.
Thank you for delivering the podcast. Oh. I listened to two last week on my way out to Marble Falls. I listened to the Kevin McKernan one. That was phenomenal. You're bringing in people from kind of outside the traditional Bitcoin voices, and then Kevin Dolan. So those are two great podcasts. So I'm a consumer of the pod, obviously. Well,
thank you. Thank you for helping us on both ends of the business. No, and honestly, like the tools are getting better. Like I mentioned, Satoshi Pacioli, like since we run our business on Zaprite.
I think it's Pacioli.
Pacioli.
I used to always get it wrong.
Pacioli. That's on me. Sorry, Joe.
I got your back.
But Zaprite, like since we invoice via Zaprite and it has fiat and Bitcoin, it makes accounting very easy. I don't stress as much as I was 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's all right there.
Running this business. Like exchange accounts, if you have, there's whether it's Strike, River, they have business accounts. They do good accounting. Like if you're using combination of self-custody Bitcoin, like Zaprite for big invoices that we receive, load up an XPub associated with one of my cold storage wallets, and that's where we receive it to. If we need to get cash with Bitcoin, I have the ability to move that Bitcoin from that wallet to an exchange to sell. I typically try not to do that. Keep a balance on the exchange, keep a balance in cold storage, keep a balance in cash.
It's
the ability to run a business on a Bitcoin standard has never been better. It's only getting better by the day.
Yeah, and there's a lot left to do. Yeah. But the more people that engage in that and use the tools, the better the tools get by reps and feedback and working out kinks and getting great ideas from customers, as well as just more customers means more revenue, means more capital to build more things. So
positive EV. It's not zero sum.
It's not zero sum.
We used a modern day example. We'll talk about it more on stage at the Bitcoin Takeover next week.
Yeah. Bitcointakeover.org. If you're interested in Zaprite, Zaprite.com. If you're interested in the piece, it's on tftc.io. It's on my blog, gradualthansuddenly.xyz. It's on my
X Twitter.
Parker A. Lewis. I feel like I'm forgetting something.
I think Zaprite.com/tftc if you want $40 off.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It's a good deal. Best deal in the market. No, I think that's it. There's other events during Bitcoin Takeover. So if you find us on Meetup, Bitcoin Commons Austin, all the events that I mentioned at the start are on the Meetup page.
Hell yeah. Come see us next week. And there's going to be a lot more of this. We've got some ideas for some evergreen content we're going to work on. So stay tuned for that,
too. Looking forward to the series.
Yeah. Peace and love, freaks.